Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we're speaking with guest expert Dr. Colleen Oren. Dr. Oren is an associate professor at William Patterson University and the author of Bernie Madoff and the Crisis. Let's hear what she has to say about Bernie Madoff and the Ponzi scheme he created. Hi, Colleen. Thanks for joining us today.
Hello, Rebecca. I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So can we start off by having you give us a little background on Bernie Madoff and his upbringing?
Bernie Madoff had a rather unremarkable upbringing. He grew up in Queens to a middle-class family. He was a very popular teenager, made money lifeguarding, was popular with the girls, went to Hofstra University, where he graduated with a degree in social sciences. He would later call it the other H university because he was embarrassed that he had not attended Harvard when all of his banking buddies went to prestigious Ivy League colleges. He did attend law school, but he dropped out. He would later kind of misrepresent that he had graduated from law school. So maybe foreshadowing of things to come. But he entered into then business as a young person through loans from his father-in-law and was by all accounts very successful as a young up-and-coming market maker in over-the-counter stocks and even a pioneer in automated trading. So back in before the 1980s, everything was paper-based. He was on top of involving computers at the time to reduce transaction times, reduce costs for everyone. So believe it or not, from humble-ish beginnings, he did obtain a remarkable degree of success for a Hofstra University graduate before the Ponzi, of course, came into being.
Then he partners, probably in the beginning, I would assume, he partners with these two accountants who worked at his father-in-law's firm, Frank Avellino and Michael Bienes. I think I'm saying that right.
Yes, that's correct.
What was the setup and how did it grow?
Right. Well, those accountants became a part of the machinery that enabled his fraud because they were a tiny little outfit in no way equipped to properly audit or be the accountants for what became a huge investment fund. And so they became a way of kind of shielding this, the Ponzi, because they weren't able to properly do accounting for him. But so, yes, yeah, so he was brought in. His father-in-law started kind of as father-in-laws do, saying that my son is this incredible market wizard. You should invest with my son-in-law. And so at first, a lot of the initial investors were friends and family of his father-in-law, Saul Alpern. And then from there, word of mouth was very much a part of how he obtained his clientele, because it was a tight-knit community. And so what metastasized into this large Ponzi originally was kind of a small side business in helping his father-in-law's friends and family with their own personal investments.
So when did the Ponzi scheme start? I know that that's one of those questions that is very difficult to answer. But when do they think, around what time did it begin?
So this is like the million-dollar question. There are some who say that his business was always, the investment business was always a Ponzi scheme. So that would have begun in the late 60s, 70s. According to Madoff's own accounts and according to what was accepted for the purposes of sentencing, it began in the late 80s, right during the time of the market recession hit. When it hit, he allegedly shorted the strategy in which he had involved his investors' money, intending to pay it back, and then the market never recovered. And so he then was never able to dig himself out of that hole. So late 80s.
Okay. So the SEC then does this internal investigation on his business and finds that, you know, the two accountants are not licensed. Should the SEC have caught onto this scheme by then? Or, you know, how was Madoff able to get away with it?
Yes. And so, you know, something that most people don't know, which is that the accountants were investigated, and by accident, therefore, Bernie Madoff was investigated by the SEC in 1992. So that was the first investigation that should have raised red flags, but it didn't. And following that, he was investigated between 6 and 8 times by the SEC.
Wow.
Yes, there were multiple investigations. Bernie Madoff himself said, he defends them a lot, or defended them before he died, defended the SEC a lot, saying they didn't have enough money to conduct proper investigations. They kind of sent their C team that weren't used to dealing with someone of his magnitude of experience and gravitas.
Yeah, major backhanded compliment on his part.
Oh, of course. Oh no, he. In case you didn't guess, he did not have a small ego. And so it's just his fraud was too complex and brilliant for the gumshoes to have caught on to it completely. And so he actually said, you know, they sent people who didn't have the Wall Street expertise to understand what I was doing. They weren't funded enough. So he defends that they were such, you know, so grossly incompetent in their investigations. In fact, there was one instance where he thought he was going to get caught. All they had to do, he gave them what's called a DTTC number, a DTCC number, which confirms that trades have happened. And so if the investigators had just confirmed that the trades had happened in the early 2000s, the whole scheme would have collapsed then and there.
Wow.
So it was such an easy thing for them to have done. He said he was expecting the FBI to come knocking on his door the next day after he gave them the DTCC number, and they never did it. So that was shocking. In addition, I'm sure you know this guy, Harry Markopoulos, but he was the big whistleblower, the quant dork, you know, that he had done the crunched all the numbers and sent the SEC a document which says the world's largest hedge fund is a Ponzi scheme, like holding nothing back, and they still just filed it away.
Wow. I mean, that's a major headline. I would have at least noticed.
Though that the yes, the world's largest hedge fund is a Ponzi scheme is eye catching.
And I'm like an I would consider myself like an N or M team. Way lower than the C team.
No, definitely. But they were definitely the C team. They were very, you know, ill prepared for dealing with the high quality bullshit that Madoff was able to spin, because he had the vocabulary, he had the kind of reputation on Wall Street of being a market wizard. So he was intimidating.
Ah, so even all the headlines that came out during the 2000s, they didn't really hurt his business in any way.
You know, it's very interesting. So there were a few headlines that came out. One was for Barron's, one was for Marhedge, both in the early 2000s, both of which got a lot of attention. And it raised red flags, interestingly, in some of the large banks. So, for example, there was an internal conversation that was happening in JP Morgan about whether or not they should be having some of their products invested in Madoff. They had a large amount of money in Madoff products at the time, $200 to $300 million. So there's, but they didn't get rid of him. And yes, he didn't lose significant clientele. So the thought is that for some of the clients, they may have thought that he was front running or doing something illegal, but they were hoping that it would continue long enough for them to continue to make profits. It's really unclear why, if there were these very skeptical articles being written in major publications for the industry, that people wouldn't be like, get my money out as soon as possible.
Right. They wanted to believe what they wanted to believe.
Yeah. Was it willful blindness? For some, could be.
Could be. So I want to talk about Frank DePascale. He's the right-hand man to Madoff's business. How did he get involved in the business, and how did his role develop throughout the years?
It's very interesting that Madoff often chose to have right-hand people who were noticeably less qualified in the sense of education, business experience than he was, and to kind of surround himself by these people, and to compensate them well, to kind of buy off their loyalty and their silence. So in Madoff's interactions with his right-hand people, a lot of the fraud took place on an entirely different floor than his regular business. And so these people acted kind of as protectors of that business, shielding Madoff in a way from the questions that would inevitably arise. And so they were eventually found culpable, along with his brother, in the scheme that they knew what was going on. Unfortunately, Frank DePasquale, or maybe I never want to say, but he passed away. And so his story, as far as finding out more about what he knew about it and the details, disappeared shortly thereafter, after he had been found guilty. He passed away of cancer, I believe.
It seems like the 2008 housing market crash and the Great Recession was the point of no return for Madoff. How did that unravel?
So, yes, it's amazing how, even if we take the late 80s as the origin point for the scheme, it was one of the longest lasting Ponzi schemes in history. Not the longest lasting, but one of the longest lasting. And so the fact that it survived recessions was remarkable. The fact that it survived all these SEC investigations and Harry Markopoulos and Marhedge and Barron's, but it couldn't survive the financial crisis. Because what ended up happening was, of course, banks stopped lending to each other. People were panicking, withdrawing their money, trying to stuff it under their mattress. So what ended up happening was that the investors normally Madoff honored redemption. So if someone wanted to take their money out, he had the liquidity to do that for them. But with the crisis, so many withdrew. He had billions of dollars in redemptions. The Ponzi scheme simply collapsed because he just didn't have the capital on hand to give it out to everyone. So, you know, oftentimes I still get in one piece of angry mail I received, someone said to me, how can you give voice, because I interviewed him, give voice to this guy who caused the financial crisis. Well, he actually didn't cause it. He was like a victim of the financial crisis himself, because his Ponzi would have kept going were it not for the fact that the economy was going, you know.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So that is remarkable. Is there any evidence that his family or more specifically his sons or his wife knew that he was running this Ponzi scheme before it came crashing down?
Interesting. So there is no evidence that his sons or Ruth knew about this beforehand. I think that Diana, some of the investigations that were really thorough yielded no evidence. And I think that given the number of lawsuits and clawbacks and everything that happened after the fraud unraveled, people were trying to get money by any means necessary to make up for their losses, understandably, that if they were involved, something would have come out. I think it's entirely believable. How many of us know really what our significant others do all day? Maybe now because of the quarantine and we're seeing each other way too much, but generally, you know, so she had been married to this very successful person who was successful before the Ponzi scheme. She was used to a high quality of life with multiple yachts and multiple homes and all of that. So the point at which the firm switched from not being a Ponzi scheme to having this Ponzi scheme, side business, would she have been able to tell? I really don't think so. As far as his sons, I also don't think that was the case. They were involved in the legitimate market making business in which he was involved, Madoff. They worked on a separate floor. I think we can say they should have been like, Dad, why is there another floor? But
the classic question,
Dad, you know,
what happens on that floor we don't go to?
You know, knocking on the door, what's happening in there? But they didn't. Mark Madoff committed suicide on the anniversary of his father's death a year later, after he was being hounded day in and day out about what he knew. And Andrew later died of cancer and blamed his father almost until the last minute that the stress had contributed to his illness. So no, there is no credible evidence that they knew. That didn't mean, of course, that they didn't have to give up a lot of money. Yes. As did, by the way, many Madoff victims had to give back a lot of the fictitious earnings that they had gotten unwittingly. So even if they didn't know, as many Madoff victims did not know, because the proceeds were ill-gotten gains, they had to give them back to other victims. So just imagine, like, you had bought something thinking that you had money in the bank. Turns out that money was the proceeds of a crime, so you have to give it back. It's been years and years and years of lawsuits and fighting over what to do about people who didn't know but nevertheless benefited from the crime.
What a nightmare for these victims.
Yes.
How wide was this scope of the victims? How many were there? And did I guess I kind of know the answer to this, but were they able to recover any losses? Probably
great.
Not.
Yeah, no, great question. So the credible number of claims for restitution that were filed in the Breeden Fund, last time I looked, were around 35,000. So it was a massive global fraud. These were not only direct victims, so people who knew that they were giving their money to this investment advisor known as Madoff. It was also people who had their money in pensions who were indirectly affected. Could you imagine, like, you find out, oh, that money I was putting into a retirement account that I thought was safe actually was with this guy who turned out to be a complete fraud. No. So it really makes you want to take all of your money and just shove it under your bed. So, the total was $65 billion in fictitious profits that were lost. At the end of the day, that the amount of principal that was lost was $17.5 billion. Of that, Madoff victims who lost $1 million or less now have gotten all of their principal back. All of it, 100%.
Wow.
Yeah. Of course, it took years. And of course, that doesn't include the money that they thought they had. And of course, the stress, you know, the gray hair that they got, all of that. And then the rest of the victims who had over $1 million, they have 75 cents on the dollar to date. So presumably in a few years, which is unusual, by the way, for a Ponzi scheme. The Madoff victims are unusual in a number of ways, the scale of the fraud, but also the scale of the effort that was made to recover that money. Usually you're SOL with these types of schemes. So they will at least have gotten some compensation, restitution.
So has there been any significant change in policy that was made at, you know, in the aftermath of this case? Essentially, could this happen again?
Oh, it already has.
Oh, no.
It already has. There have been a number of high dollar Ponzi schemes since then. In fact, prosecutions of Ponzi schemes went up after the Madoff case, which kind of makes the point that deterrence, like the idea of throwing someone away for 150 years, that would deter other people from cooking up their own scheme, that doesn't hold any water. So there have been quite a few high profile Ponzi schemes since then. It absolutely can happen again. Anytime too, you have a new technology, a new product. So for instance, cryptocurrencies, you can imagine that in short order, there will be Ponzi schemes that are being cooked up to draw people in. Under the promise of steady returns or profits that are unusual, because where there is the idea that you are losing out on an opportunity of a lifetime, our psychology is always, well, this might be too good to be true, but this might also be way too good to pass up on. What if I'm the sucker sitting out as this skyrockets and I'm losing out on this golden opportunity? So as long as human psychology exists like this, and as long as there are people who know that that's how we think and can take advantage of it, there will be Ponzi schemes. As far as policies that have changed, a few things I would like to point out. First of all, the SEC, which was a convenient scapegoat for a lot of this. They took a lot of heat for the Madoff, somewhat rightfully so. They issued like a 400-page self-whipping report, red flags, here's what we missed, here's what we missed, here's what we missed. To be fair to the SEC, their budget has not kept pace with the amount of transactions that they're responsible for policing. So even if you change the policy, if there's not the manpower and woman power, and if there's not the resources to transactions, importantly, the SEC, all of these government organizations that police Wall Street, they are super reliant on the private sector, because those are the people that see, like, banks are the people that see money going in, money going out of accounts. So JP Morgan was Bernie Madoff's banker. They were the ones who should have alerted the relevant cops that something was going on. Oh. Yes. Guess what? 1998, there were employees at JP Morgan saying, there are so many red flags with this account. I don't think it's too good to be true. We shouldn't be involved with this guy. Was ignored. No suspicious activity. Yeah, 1998, no suspicious activity report was filed. In the 2000s, JP Morgan, the London branch, said, we can't do business with him anymore because we are convinced that that this is possibly illegal. London wouldn't bank with him, but New York didn't shut his account. So JP Morgan ended up in a deferred prosecutorial agreement, which they had to pay $1.7 billion in fines because of because of Madoff. So what changed was they had to beef up their program of providing red flags for accounts that were so obviously fraudulent, like Madoff. So things did change, not only in government, but also it scared the heck out of some private sector actors, because, I mean, $1.7 billion for JP Morgan is not, you know, they wouldn't close their doors over it, but it's a lot of money. And so it forced them to invest in more anti-money laundering, more due diligence. So they had to step up after the Madoff scheme too.
Okay. So after, I have to ask the hardest question.
All right.
At the end of the day, if you had to pick one person or thing, it can be a concept or a systemic failure that is to blame for the Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme. Who or what would that be?
Okay. I think there is so much blame to go around that we could spend all day talking about that. I do think that even as a sociologist who is very interested in how systems impact ability to get away with things, differential policing of people according to race, class, et cetera, I must say that ultimately, irreducibly, it comes down to the individual. Madoff ultimately could have made the decision to, when he saw things going to hell in the late 80s, when he wasn't able to make the profits that he was promising his investors, instead of admitting, hey, I'm a market wizard, but I can't do it right now. Instead of saying that, admitting that he couldn't constantly generate huge profits, instead of doing that, he chose to short the market and begin the Ponzi scheme, perhaps unintentionally, as 25% of Ponzi schemes are unintentional. But nevertheless, he kept up the lie as it kept metastasizing, as he saw more and more victims being drawn in, including Elie Wiesel, including people with kids to put through college and all of that. So I think that it would be negligent of me to blame it on the systems. and not to say, hell, you know, Bernie Madoff was ultimately primarily responsible for this. But then if we start at the individual level, because ultimately that's where it resides. If it weren't for the individual, there'd be no other blame to go around. But then from there, Frank DiPasquale, the accountants who were involved, his brother, who went to prison, by the way, for his complicity in signing off on it, the bad faith victims, there were people who actually knew that they were involved in a Ponzi, the bad faith victims who just kept cashing it in, had 900% profits. The system that would rather, you know, turn a blind eye to a big market maker than to look a little bit closer, like JP Morgan, because he was generating huge profits for them. the system of capitalism in general that rewards that rewards
the biggie
that rewards risk taking and speculation rather than actual work being done that produces real value, that creates fictitious profits, etc. So I think from that kernel of the individual, then we keep building and building and building, and we get to the systemic, but all bear some small or large measure of accountability in the end. Who's to blame? Lots of people.
Lots of people. And you know what? We couldn't have done it without you, Colleen. Thank you for helping us understand this very complicated and yet not so complicated, financial scheme.
Yes, no, my pleasure. And I think that it's important that maybe like as a word of advice, that it seems Madoff, when he was speaking to me, tried to also make it seem more complicated than it was, to ask ourselves, because whatever little money, I know people who are broke who are doing day trading, right? But so whatever little money you have, if you don't understand what is being promoted, what is being, how your money is being invested, to actually say, hey, wait a minute, explain this to me as if I were a kindergartner. And if you still don't understand, hey, I think the lesson of Madoff is keep your money in a savings account.
Incredible advice. And you know what? That's what we here at The Alarmist do every single week. Explain it to us as if I was a kindergarten kid. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
With us today, we have producer Amanda Lund.
Hello, Rebecca, and hello to the Alarmy.
Now, what I mean, first of all, I know I say this all the time, but I wish Dr. Oren was my teacher.
Your teacher. I know. I was thinking the same thing. She was so, just how excited she got at some of those questions was amazing. I was like, this woman knows a lot about Ponzi schemes.
And she just said something like in the end, which I kind of wanted to ask her more about, but that only 25% of Ponzi schemes that people don't realize they're getting themselves into.
Fascinating. I think what she means is 25% of Ponzi schemes, the criminals don't intend to be Ponzi schemes. Oh. And it reminded me of this docu-series I've been watching on HBO Max called Generation Hustle. And each episode centers around a scam. And most of them are Ponzi schemes that start out well-intentioned, and then the person makes a mistake, and instead of coming clean to the investors, they decide to lie and cover up. And these are not on the same scale as Bernie Madoff. I mean, they cover WeWork. They also cover this frat guy who started this basically hedge fund from his frat house and then like got in really deep with all of his friends who had invested like thousands of dollars. So I highly recommend Generation Hustle to you and also anyone else who's interested in learning more about these Ponzi schemes, because like almost all of them started out pretty sincere.
Well, it makes me think then that we should have perhaps put up on the board that moment of truth, because Dr. Arend also mentioned that there was this moment where Madoff could have come clean, had it been in the 80s when there was that financial crisis. Perhaps if he had just come clean or said, I messed up, you know, instead of like trying to doctor up and look like he was this financial genius, which clearly he wasn't. And being a scam, a con artist, is it doesn't make you a genius. It makes you a liar.
Yeah, and I think that actually really plays into something we did put up on the board, which is ego.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's that moment where it's your ego and your pride, or we had toxic pride up on the board. It won't allow you to admit that you made a mistake. And so you really see that moment with a lot of these schemes as well, where the person just can't admit, they're too embarrassed. And that plays into pride and ego.
That's scary because, thank you, dogs. They agree. they're so scared too. It's really scary because it makes you realize that there's a moment in your life where, you know, it's Gwyneth Paltrow, sliding doors. It's that sliding doors moment that inevitably everyone has, I'm assuming.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if only Madoff had a podcast like The Alarmist to listen to, where he could have seen. But you know what? The thing is, it wouldn't have mattered because people like that think they're the exception to the rule.
Yep. He's not listening to The Alarmist because he's not alarmed by anything.
He's got it under control.
Yeah. That's scary.
So there are a couple other things that Colleen said that I think we might just want to quickly breeze through to get your perspective on.
Yeah.
She went hard on the banks and the private sector. And I was kind of feeling like, ooh, maybe we were a little bit tough on the SEC and not hard enough on the private sector like JP Morgan.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes what happens with these private banks is, like she said, I don't understand how they work. And sometimes it's really hard to go hard on these things that we don't really fully understand. But I trust her. It's probably for the best.
Well, but also, you know what we have, Rebecca, is like what we said in the episode is that, well, we don't have high expectations for the private sector, so we can't really blame them. But I actually think we need to raise the bar for them, because it's kind of not okay to let them off the hook.
No, and we didn't for the financial crisis of 2008. We didn't. And perhaps this is another one where we shouldn't have let them off the hook. And you're right. Corporations should be responsible for their clients. And in a way, like they let their clients down.
Totally. And also it's like so she rattled off that amazing list at the end there, and a couple of them we had missed. So another one was, I think we could have put FOMO up on the board because she talked about fear of losing out on a great opportunity.
Oh, yeah. FOMO, come on. Missed opportunity, right? For us.
And I get that. She also said that, let's see. Oh, the accountants, his brother, the bad faith victims, which were the investors who knew it was a Ponzi scheme but didn't care, banks, capitalism that rewards risk-taking. So we didn't actually, you talk about the brother at the end, but we didn't actually put the brother up on the board.
We didn't. You're right. We did put those accountants up.
Yeah.
And we discussed them, and we talked about DePasquale, his right-hand man. But
yeah,
you're right. There were a lot of bad faith victims.
There were. So I don't know, like, does this make you want to rethink the verdict? Because just to remind everyone, we did send Bernie Madoff to jail, and Colleen said she believes irreducibly it comes down to Madoff.
Wow, this is like the first time ever that we all agree to just send the person who did the crime to the alarmist jail. But maybe we
slapped the SEC.
Yeah, I mean, they did take the fall, as they should have, I guess, when it all went down. But perhaps we, at the alarmist, should have been slapping the banks.
Yeah, she brought up a good point that the SEC is like pretty underfunded. But then it made me suspicious when she said that Madoff was defending them.
Right. To you, yeah. I mean, again, you know what? Should we just keep it as is?
I think we could keep it as is, because we've gotten the banks before. We're constantly going after capitalism. We know that they're, you know, they're bad.
Yeah.
For the most part, in some ways.
Except scenarios. For the ones that the bank that has my money in it, I would like it to just hold my crumbs.
Yeah. The ones that have our crumbs, they're okay. But we've gone after them in the past. So it's not like we've been totally ignorant to their misdeeds.
Right. And again, the SEC, like, how many red flags does it take for you to open an investigation and just like look into it a little further? I mean, this is, we're talking, I know that they had a lot on their plate, but what could have been more important at the time than like this guy who's committing fraud, you know, fraud with billions and billions of dollars. What could have been more important at the time? I don't know. Maybe someone has the answer out there. Okay, so let's keep it as is. But I'm glad we discussed all of these other things that we should have put up on the board. Now, Amanda, is there any housekeeping stuff that we should do before we end this episode?
Yes, thank you, Rebecca. So we've been putting our call out to get 100 new reviews by our 100th episode, which is a few weeks away. And this has been stalled. We were making great headway. We were, you know, cashing in reviews left and right. And then something happened with Apple Podcasts where there is a glitch in their system that has shut down all reviews on certain podcasts. And unfortunately, The Alarmist is one of those podcasts.
Who is to blame over at Apple Podcasts?
Trust me, I have been tweeting at them. We've been emailing. There's no way to get a hold. Of course, you can't get a hold of a person for the customer service. You have to just submit an email form. It's been an ongoing saga. It's been down for a week. So, yeah, so we're pausing. We're hitting pause on that. But I have a feeling, hopefully, I'm crossing my fingers that the issue is resolved within a week. And in the meantime, maybe consider listening on a different platform and leaving us a review there. That would be great.
That could be good. And I bet you by the time that, hopefully by the time this airs on Thursday, it will have been, you know, settled.
But I hope so. So
I hope so, yeah, too.
I really do. And I, you know, honestly, for their sake, because the wrath of the alarmist, you do not want that coming after you.
No. And we've had some people tweeting at us and just contacting us and telling us about this situation. So I hear you. We're trying to fix it. But in the meantime, do as Amanda said, perhaps review elsewhere. So
yeah, or maybe you could just spend some more time like doing a few different drafts of your review. I'm just expecting that by the time it fixes itself, everyone's reviews are going to be like essays, really thoughtful essays. So just keep working on that. Send it in an email to yourself. Have a friend proofread it. And then the minute we're back up, baby, we'll let you know and you can post it.
That's a good advice. Really. Yeah. Save it on your notes section on your phone.
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Hopefully we'll get all of this settled. And if not, we're going to have to get the, perhaps we'll have to get the web crawlers girls involved. Hopefully this isn't some kind of conspiracy against the alarmists that, you know, that would be bad.
Web crawlers is experiencing the same thing, and they are, they're on it. So I have faith that they'll get through somehow.
But in the meantime, we're still here. We're still recording episodes, and tune in next week because we are going to be discussing who's to blame for the tragic events that happened in New Jersey's Action Park. You're not going to want to miss.
Earios.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.